This is Wade Cunningham, and you need more front wing.
Hello and welcome to another Forefront Wing podcast. I'm Steph Holcraft, joined as always by Paul Dalby. And we wanted to issue our apologies for not showing up in your inboxes last week. Unfortunately, shortly after I returned home from Long Beach, I ended up with some kind of terrible flu bug. And nobody wants to listen to Paul talk to himself for an hour. So we just thought that we would we'd call the whole thing off and address it all this week for you. So we're back. Sorry if we missed you. We hope you missed us, too. And we have with us this week Chris Estrada, who is a fellow contributor to IndyCar Nation and also runs IndyRacingRevolution.com. Chris, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Great. So we never did get a chance to talk about some of the talking points at Long Beach. A lot of it has really been talked out, so we're not going to spend too much time on it. But there were a couple of things that were worth bringing up. The contact at the beginning of the race between Joseph Newgarden and Dario Franchitti, I don't think anybody is ever going to have the complete answer on this. My viewpoint, for what it's worth, granted there was a fence in the way, I was sitting on the opposite side of the track at the grandstand that was not immediately at turn six, but next to it. So I had a pretty good view of the car, the back of the cars going into and through the apex one. And again, there was a fence in the way, but from what I saw, it looked an awful lot to me like Dario squeezed Joseph over into the wall. And now I'm not a professional. Simon Pagenaud is a professional. He agrees with me. That being said, I don't know that I completely disagree with still calling it a racing incident, because Joseph really had no business trying to do what he was trying to do in the first turn of the first lap. And I think Dario giving him a little bit of a wrist slap isn't necessarily a bad thing, and just putting him in his place a little bit. It's kind of a shame that it ended in contact and ended his race, and the Joseph and the team are definitely justified in being a little bit grumpy about that if it is the case that Dario was in any way intentional in his movements. But a racing incident is the right way to categorize it as far as from what I saw from where I was sitting, and that is ultimately how Bo Barfield called it, so I guess he agrees too. Did you guys have any thoughts on that?
I only got to see, obviously, I only saw the race on television, and I only had, I think NBC Sports Network only had like 3 or 4 replays after the incident occurred. But from what I saw, I thought Joseph had position on him, but as they were going through the turn and it started tightening up, I thought Joseph kind of came down a little bit on Franchitti as they were going through the turn. I think that just made the contact unavoidable. Personally, I thought it took a lot of guts on his part to make a bold move like that in the first turn in the first lap. And I think he's to be commended for his guts and also to be commended for his attitude that he had afterwards. But I do agree with IndyCar on their no call. I think that was just an unavoidable racing incident on their part. Obviously, as you mentioned, the Sarah Fisher Hartman Racing team may not see it that way, but I think that was a pretty good no call on Bo Barfield's part there.
I'm always happy when I see a race director erring on the side of not making calls. I prefer the approach of not interfering unless it's absolutely clearly evident that it's necessary to do so. And so I'm always going to be happy when I see officials leaning more toward that style of officiating. And maybe that's because I come from hockey country. I don't know. Paul, anything to add?
I think I would agree with you guys. But from where, although I disagree with what Eric said, I don't think it was this brazen, bold move that Newgarden tried to put on Dario. He drafted him very well down the long straight, and by the time they got to the turn, he had almost the entire car ahead of Dario.
He did. And I was when I saw them going into the turn, I was screaming like, "You go, kid!" Because it looked like he had it locked up to me from where I was sitting.
I mean, all indications are the contact, as little as there was Dario's front wing to Joseph's rear tire. It wasn't even tire to tire. Joseph was all the way past him, and we saw throughout the rest of the race that Dario had problems on the restarts getting through the gears and getting down to turn one.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like Joseph, like at the maybe it was late getting into turn one, but he certainly was early enough that he got his entire car almost past him. He had that turn, in my opinion. I mean, he was all the way past him enough where Dario, I think, should have. Obviously, he had to have seen him. I think Dario could have gotten out. Let's worry about it past the first turn. He's already that far ahead of him. That being said, I also agree. I don't think he should have been penalized. I don't think Dario should have been penalized. First of all, I don't want to see every little itty-bitty contact like that bring out a penalty. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a malicious move by any chance. I don't think Dario intended in any way to punt young Joseph into the tires. I think Dario could have given more room, but I don't think he in any way had intent to take Joseph out. And beyond that, I don't think Bo Barfield had enough evidence to, without a doubt, say that there was contact at the time. So, Steph, I agree with you, believe it or not. I don't want to see them throwing penalties all the time. I would prefer that if there is any doubt as to whether there's contact or not, err on the side that there was not contact. I think that when you start doling out penalties, you had better be, you know, sure beyond any sort of reasonable doubt that there was, in fact, A, there was a contact, and B, that there was some intent or, you know, some lack of driver control that caused it. I don't think either of those applied in this situation, so I completely agree with the no call, even though I do agree that Dario probably could have given him a little more room and probably should have given up the corner, but he didn't. Joseph will probably learn whether or not makes that move again. I think he probably will, because like I said, I don't think it was that bold or brazen of a move. I think he had the corner. I think he had the move completed. Just didn't quite work out this time.
Well, here's the thing with DB telling you that it's a bold move. It's just obviously a rookie in his third start in the big cars going mano a mano against the three-time reigning champion, four-time champion the last 5 years.
And being on the front row as a matter of chance, which is another important point to add. He didn't really qualify there.
Neither one of them did.
So,
no, that's true.
Yeah, that too. Mm-hmm.
So,
but that's what I meant from the bold move, just the general aspect of that, just that, like you said, he did have the position going into the corner, but still, he's a rookie, third start, going against one of the big dogs. Do you really expect him to go the outside way in a treacherous turn like turn one at Long Beach? I would say many people would say no, but he went ahead and did it.
Probably not, but Dario took such an extreme low line into that turn. Where was Joseph going to go? And he didn't have anywhere else to go. Just to even make the turn, he really needed to take that outside line. The fact is that he broke later, and Dario must have probably broke earlier, I guess.
You're the one that excuse me, that pointed out that Dario was slow into the corner to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So,
as he was on subsequent restarts.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a lot of talking to say. We agree. Let's move on. I guess the other major point to discuss from Long Beach is the fact that Will Power started, what was it, 12th?
Yeah, pretty much 12th.
Yeah, 12th, yes.
And after incurring a 10-spot penalty on the starting grid, for something that was completely not his fault and was dealt by IndyCar to all of the Chevy entries, as we all know, overcame that, did what Paul said that he was not able to do, and kept his head in it and kept the pressure on while he was further back in the pack and under pressure, and pulled out another win. Can anybody stop him, guys?
That was just such a stellar drive
mm-hmm.
by Power, and also obviously.
Sorry to throw that in there, but there's another guy who's driving
right.
the heck out of these cars this year. It was really fun to watch that last lap of that race. If he had one more lap, he would have been giving Will a run for his money. But anyway, sorry to interrupt, Chris.
No, that's no problem. He's had back-to-back stellar drives now. Ninth to first at Barber at a track that had been regarded as almost unpassable, and now you go from 12th to first at Long Beach, such a tricky street course there. Obviously, he's in the catbird seat for the championship right now. Granted, it's only three races old. The season's only three races old, but for him to do this back-to-back on such tough tracks, I have to think that maybe there could be a bit of a demoralizing aspect for the rest of the field, knowing that even when he's buried in mid-pack, he can still come up and just do these great drives, be able to save fuel when he can, but push when he's also able to do that, and just have all the bases covered, both him and his Team Penske crew. And obviously his crew deserves a lot of credit as well. I mean, you don't make up that many spots without good pit work and good strategy from Cindric and the guys on the pit crew there. But I have to believe there's some sort of demoralization thing going with the rest of the field. They're like going, he was in the back of the pack. He was in mid-pack to start, and he still was able to beat us. So, and now he's going to Sao Paulo, where he's won twice in the rain now. So he's definitely got an edge on people going into this race here this weekend.
Much has been made about the fact that Will Power, so much of his performance is based on his psyche, his own perception of his abilities and his momentum. And, I mean, you got to think that unless something crazy happens, that Sao Paulo is probably a lock for him. Indy, not necessarily so much, but With the schedule being so heavy on road and street courses as it is, it's looking more and more like it's going to be a runaway this year. Paul, anything to add?
Not much. It is astounding what he's been able to do. Not only does it have to be demoralizing, but absolutely demoralizing, as Chris said, for the rest of the field. What I've noticed is he just seems as a calmer driver when he's on track. I've always kind of felt before that he was kind of very bonsai. And when he got out front, and like you said, I did say that, that he had a lot of trouble coming from mid-pack. It seemed like he was, I just got the feeling he was very antsy and anxious when he got back in the pack and very frustrated when he was back there. But I think what I've seen him this year, he just seems so much more calm when he drives. And he's not trying to go from ninth to first at Barber, 12th to first at Long Beach. He's not trying to do it in 10 laps. Mm-hmm. He's letting the race come to him. As Dale Nixon, we were talking about terribly used euphemisms, and that was one I just said the other day was overused. But nonetheless, yeah, he allows the race to really to come to him. He doesn't force his way to the front right away. He recognizes there's going to be some people ahead of him drop out, and he realizes there are good times to pass and there are not good times to pass. And I think he seems to have really matured in the last year or so, and he's learned how to get himself to the front when it matters. And at the end of 5 or 10 laps, he realizes isn't the time that pays the money. And I think that's what's different about his drive this year, at least what I've seem to notice about his drive this year. You know, I remember saying at Barber when he was, halfway through the race and he was up to like sixth or fifth position or something like that, I said, oh, look at that. Will Power is not moving through the field. And then I look at the score and he's already halfway up and he hasn't been making huge moves. So, it's just a very different drive that he seems to have this year. And if he continues down this path, I don't see how he gets caught. Because this is the type of driving that is also critical for him to show on the ovals where we haven't seen it, that patience of, especially in Indianapolis where you have to go 500 miles, but even the shorter ones where you talk about 200, like 225, 250 miles at Milwaukee, 200 plus at Iowa, and then again 300 at Texas and whatever Fontana is this year. You know, those are longer are longer races that require patience. And if Will has really learned that patience this year, it may already be lights out. I don't see how anyone can catch him at this point.
Well, time will tell.
I think it's going to – yeah, that definitely. But I also think that I know a lot of us are going to probably say that it will be lights out, but he's still – I still have a feeling that you're going to see maybe a couple more races like St. Petersburg where he's just going to have to, like you mentioned, showcase that newfound patience and just try to get as much as he can out of the car, out of the situation that he's in. Obviously, he finished seventh at St. Petersburg. He just couldn't quite break out of the traffic, even though he said afterwards that was probably the best car that he'd ever had. So that's going to be probably the only thing that might be able to stop him. Just he has to be able to capitalize on the days where he won't be able to see the front, obviously. And I think there's going to be a couple more races like that. But as I've said, and as you guys have said, I think he really is in the prime position to really finally take the IndyCar championship this year, especially with what's happened with Dario Franchitti right now.
Mm-hmm. But, Chris, don't you agree that the willpower of 2011 and definitely of 2010, if he had been in the same position at St. Petersburg, he probably would have pushed to get himself to second or third, and he either would have gotten there by some bonsai run or he would have walled the car doing it. And now he seems to just accept what the car has. He's going to push it to the limit, but he's not going to push it so far over the limit that he – you know, loses these valuable points in the process of doing it.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? That may be a byproduct of what he's learned going up against Dario Franchitti, the guy that's an absolute master at being able to maximize the amount of points he can get with the car that he has, with the pace that he has at a certain weekend.
Don't underestimate the effect of having Tim Cindric on the stand on that either.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Major
That's
calming
true.
Influence on that and steadying influence.
And to that end, his crew has been rock solid since that switch was made last year at Toronto. I don't think they've had one pit crew-induced problem. He obviously had the pit problem at Kentucky last year with
Beatrice.
He had that problem. That obviously had no reflection on the efforts of the crew. But they have been solid since Cindric came on board on that team.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel obligated to talk a little bit about my experience actually attending the event at Long Beach, but I'm not sure why, because there have been 37 of these before this year, and me, just little old me, walking around at something as big as Long Beach, I don't feel like anything that I've got to say really is any way insightful. But once we got past Friday, which was horrible, I can't remember the last time I felt so wet in my life. My pants were soaked, my shoes were soaked, my baby was soaked. I had my daughter with me that weekend. It was nasty. We spent 2 hours hiding in the Chili's in turn one because you just didn't want to be outside. But once that blew by, it was beautiful. And it was sunny, and it was warm, but there was a cool breeze off the ocean, and there were tons of people, and they were all happy and friendly and having a great time, and everybody had all their gear on from years long gone by, dedicated, hardcore fans. It's Long Beach. I don't know what else to tell you.
It seems like such a fantastic destination race, but as it is the second biggest race, obviously, on the calendar, behind the Indianapolis 500. I tell you, I saw the Friday videos, and it sure didn't look like fun out there. It looked like an absolute gully washer down there on Friday. But after that, as you mentioned, it looked like the skies were just sunny. Everybody was having a really good time. I think I got racked up almost like 170,000 over the three-day weekend. Is that right?
Something around that. You believe it walking around the place. Yeah, it was a busy, busy place. It was a great atmosphere, lots of fun. One thing that is worth mentioning is, of course, on Friday, with the weather being the way it was, I got quite a bit of time to walk around inside the Fan Expo, and there is some really great tie-ins. For the locations that are going to have the ability to host these kind of fan expo kind of deals like Long Beach does and Toronto will as well. I'm sure Baltimore must have something. I'm sure there are a couple more as well I'm not thinking of. But any place on the calendar that's got the ability to have this sort of little indoor trade show kind of deal going on, there is a lot of product tie-in between sponsors and driver appearances and advertising going on this year, much more so than we've seen in the last few years. And that's really encouraging to see those opportunities being capitalized on and grown. You couldn't go very far without seeing Fuzzy's Vodka and Charlie Kimball's face that weekend. Both partnerships that are really, really working tirelessly to grow from within the sport and outside. So very encouraging, very cool stuff. Good to see that growing, and hopefully it increases opportunities all around for everyone. Anyhow, let's move on from Long Beach and talk about some of the news items that have come up in the last week or so. Obviously, one of the biggest ones is the news that Brian Herta Autosport and Dreyer and Reinbold have parted ways with Lotus. Ostensibly from the press release under reasonable terms, although I think there's much, much more to be read into that than any of us have seen. I'll tell you, I got to talk to a couple of team members over Long Beach weekend, and demoralized doesn't really cover it the way that those organizations were feeling. So to see them sort of do a bit of a bonsai move with no apparent plan, although I'm sure there have been backroom talks, but nobody seems to know anything firm about what engines those teams are going to have for the Indianapolis 500, is not as surprising as you might think, given the way that those teams were feeling for the first race.
Well, there have been reports that maybe Dreyer and Reinbold would go to Chevrolet and Brian Herta also would go to the Honda, but that's more, I think it's more of a prediction from, I believe, Kirk Tavin from the Indianapolis Star. But yeah, as you mentioned, nothing official has been made on that front right now.
I think the most surprising thing is that they obviously wouldn't have made that decision unless they had at least a verbal indication that that Chevy and Honda were going to be on board. I'm really surprised that Chevy and Honda were willing to play along, because my understanding was that they just were not interested in expanding the entries that they had because of costs and all those sorts of things. So I was a bit surprised when I first got an inkling that this story was developing. That was the first thought that popped into my head was, sure, they don't want to be with Lotus anymore. That's nice, but are the other two actually going to step up and give them engines? And I was a bit surprised that they apparently found it fairly easy. Paul?
Well, yeah, Paul, you got anything to say?
Well, yeah. I think at this point, I don't think anybody really wanted Brian Herta Autosport, the defending Indianapolis 500 champions, going back to Indianapolis. A, they're going back without Dan Weldon, unfortunately. But B, if they go back with a Lotus engine that's completely uncompetitive and really risk missing the field. I mean, quite honestly, we thought it was, you know, at some point it was a long shot 2 years ago when you had Sebastian Savedra making the field. It may be a long shot making it this year with the Lotus. If we get to the 34 or 35 entries, and we'll talk about that later on, depending on where those entries come from, you know, you have to think that Lotus is probably on the bottom of the pecking order. So a opportunity for Brian Herta Autosport to get out of the Lotus, the uncompetitive Lotus, I think it's a win not only for Brian Herta Autosport, but I think it's a win for IndyCar in general and the Indianapolis 500. I don't think you want to risk, and obviously it's happened before where defending champions haven't made the field. You think back to 1995, of course. Or 1993 when Bobby Rahal is the defending kart champion missed the race. But we're in a little bit different era now, and I think it would be very detrimental to that team and really a knock against the league if BHA wasn't in there. So I'm not surprised that IndyCar went along with this. And I think getting fewer cars for Lotus to concentrate with, so long as they're committed long term and especially committed to growth in 2013, as they say they have been, I think it's going to be a win for Lotus in the long term. It's probably a bit of a black eye now, although they've been getting black eyes every time they show up at the track. So, you know, maybe it's a smaller black eye now. I don't know. But I think it's going to be a win for BHA. I think it's going to be a win for Dreyer and Reinbold. And I think it's going to be a win for IndyCar in general. So I don't really see any negatives to this. Let's just hope the positives come to fruition here. As those teams move forward with their new partners.
You don't see any negatives, really. I don't see how Lotus bounces back from this. I don't see how next year Lotus is playing along. How are they going to convince a team to actually sign up with them next year?
How did Honda convince a team in 1994 to sign up with them? Or
different times,
95,
very different
I guess.
Times.
I mean, look how long Toyota struggled when they came in with Dan Gurney and All-American Racers. You know, they struggled for a long time. Honda struggled. Every manufacturer, really, that comes in. I mean, even Chevrolet, when they first came in 20-plus years, 25 years ago, they struggled. Lotus and Judd are coming into this very new. Honda and Chevrolet both have parts. You know, it's kind of like a somewhat amicable divorce where Honda with HPD and Chevrolet with Ilmor, they came from the same team, really, in the last spec era. So both of the Honda and Chevrolet teams now come from stock, if you will, that's already been very successful. The Lotus and Judd combination has been out of IndyCar. Judd's been out since, 1990, I would guess, 89, 90, somewhere in that ballpark?
A little later than that, because I started paying attention in 90, and I recall hearing the name Judd for at least a year or two.
Well, Bobby Rahal drove the Judd in 1989. Seemed like he had a win with it. Raul Boisel, I think, drove it that year. And if I don't remember them coming along in 90, but there may have been some still left over at that time. Regardless, you're still talking 20-plus years, and, of course, Lotus has been gone since the late 60s, so early 70s. So it's not like either one of those partners have recent experience in IndyCar. So, you know, it's a very difficult road to hoe for that team. And I think the teams, as you say, it is a different era than when Honda first came in 94 or when Toyota was first trying to get on board. But I think there's still the teams that can use that engine, that can build their program around the growth of that engine, and not necessarily be affected by the fact that it's not winning races today.
I don't know. You got a lot more confidence than I do. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I'm sorry. You go ahead with your thoughts.
No. I think all I was really going to do was rehash what I'd already said. A different perspective would be welcomed.
All right. Well, obviously, above all else, I'm saying the obvious here. They just need more testing. They need more time. Honda and Chevrolet came in here with more resources. They had more time to create this, whereas Lotus has had a litany of problems just getting onto the track for their testing, and now obviously that ownership issue continues with them. I'm sure that's played a part in what's happened with the IndyCar program for them. Just above all else, they need more testing time, they need more development, and like Paul said, I think going to a smaller outfit will help them in the long term. Just the only thing is, as you mentioned, I think it does look like another black eye for them, obviously in the public relations side, but at this point, you can't worry about what anybody else is saying. You just have to put your head down and just keep trying to find ways to get more speed out of that engine and just try to show up to Sao Paulo and then Indianapolis ready to fight, really, just ready to be competitive and say, getting maybe like a last row start or missing the field entirely. obviously the series does not want Lotus to fall flat on its face, especially at the biggest race in the world. Nobody wants to see them turn into nothing more than basically rolling chicanes, as I wrote on my blog recently. Just really, above all else, they just need to let everybody just kind of talk their talk and just keep their heads down. Just try to find a way to get that engine competitive as best they can with the people that they have.
Well,
and if you want to look at turning a negative into a positive, you know, perhaps this gives a good opportunity for the teams. Remember what happened to Penske and Ganassi following the 2005 season after they had struggled with the Toyota engines that were so down on power then, and they really had to work to make their car setups better. And then when they got the engines that can make them competitive, they were leaps and bounds ahead of the competition. Now, I'm not saying that HVM Racing is all of a sudden going to be leaps and bounds ahead of the competition.
Good, because that would be a little extreme.
Oh, obviously. But at the same time, you know, if HVM now has to focus on getting their car right and really focus on finding all those tricks that can really make the car itself go fast and really understand the aerodynamic and the mechanical means of the car.
Yeah, but you need an engine that's actually going to go forward first.
Well, okay.
That's a bigger problem.
Yes, the reliability issues are certainly something that has to get worked on, and I think they will. I hope they will.
You have to do something. Do something with it. And obviously, I think that's a very good idea for them with HVM and Dragon now. I think they really do need to go over the DW12 with a fine-tooth comb and see if they can find any aerodynamic tricks and massage the cars and just try to make it as slick as they possibly can. So once, as you mentioned, those reliability issues get worked out, they'll stand a better chance in the second half of the year.
Here's a hypothetical, though. Remember when Lotus was first announced, everyone assumed the engine was going to be built by Cosworth, not Judd. It was supposed to be Cosworth. Where would they be now, do you think, if Cosworth had actually built this engine, if they had the chance to design it from the outset?
I wonder if we'll find out next year.
It's an interesting thing, yeah.
There are sort of little whispers that Cosworth might be interested, so.
With the blue oval, or are you hearing other things as well?
No, that's the blue oval is what I've been hearing. What have you been hearing?
We've heard about Fiat or some portion of the who is that? Daimler? It's Chrysler, Daimler. I think
it's
they've
Fiat
now.
Chrysler.
It's just Chrysler now.
Chrysler, okay.
Well, Fiat, yes. They're partners with Fiat now, yeah. They haven't been with Daimler for a long time.
I mean, we've heard that rumor for the last couple of years. We've heard Audi or Volkswagen, someone in that conglomerate. But I think there are a lot of people that would love to see the Ford Cosworth name back in IndyCar racing. I don't know. I haven't heard anything more than grumblings and rumors. 13's getting here pretty quickly, though. I don't know if they can get it done, quite honestly, in time for 13. I think you're probably looking at 14 at this point, to be totally frank with you.
Well, we shall see, I guess. Let's continue on the topic of engines and talk about this appeal that's happening today by the time people get to listen to this. So this will be old news very shortly, but this appeal that's being held in Indianapolis for the changes that Honda wants to make to its, I hope I'm understanding this correctly, I'm really not an engineer, but I think it's the housing for the turbocharger that they want to make alterations to.
It is the compressor cover to the Honda single turbo. Yeah, it is the housing.
So Chevy, not happy, filed an appeal. That's to be heard today, April 26th, and I'm sure that we will get the results for that very shortly. What I'm wondering about is what effect this will have on the weekend in Brazil, because I doubt very much that the Honda engines shipped with the materials that they would need to go back, since all of this was approved before they left. And the only other comment that I have is, of course, Chevy is unhappy. They're dominating everything. Why wouldn't they file a protest? They don't want Honda to make changes because Chevy's winning right now.
I don't see any way Chevrolet wins this appeal, to be quite honest. I think if there was any question, remember, Honda already went here and IndyCar told them, or Honda already changed these. and IndyCar said, take them off, because, or IndyCar approved it, Chevrolet complained, IndyCar said, okay, fine, take them off Honda. Then IndyCar went back, reviewed what they had, and said, okay, Honda, now you can do it again. I don't see IndyCar having allowed Honda the second time to put them on if they weren't pretty certain that it was within the rules. Obviously, they knew Chevrolet was going to be upset and that a protest would be a high likelihood. I just don't see IndyCar saying, okay, go ahead and do these if they thought there was any chance Chevrolet could appeal and really win this. So from that standpoint, I just don't see very likely at all that Chevrolet wins this appeal.
Well, the other thing to consider is that this is a third-party part, is it not?
Yes.
The turbochargers are being built by BorgWarner, right?
Correct.
So it's really not completely Honda's problem, if I'm understanding correctly.
And what I understand that BorgWarner was supposed to kind of bring the deficiencies, make them equalize if there is any trouble. Is that right? If they would be called on to get rid of these deficiencies, if that was the case.
My understanding was that BorgWarner had up front, they had two different sizes of these turbochargers. For the Honda, there was a smaller and there was a larger. I thought that, and again, I think I'm like you, Steph, I'm getting way out of my technical realm here. But I thought once upon a time that they were going to be allowed to switch those, depending on the event. Maybe I'm completely off base.
Oh, I don't recall ever hearing that. But I do, the part about the different sizes does ring a bell. No, I can't speak intelligently beyond that. I'm going to get myself into trouble. The end result, though, is that I don't see how this change gets made by Brazil. Paul's absolutely right that this has already been looked at once and reversed for when they could take a closer look at it outside of an event weekend. And then they said, yeah, okay, guys, go ahead. So they wouldn't have done that unless they were pretty darn sure that they knew what they were doing. And Will Phillips came out and said, we were always intending for this to be more or less equal. That's what this change is working toward. We don't really have a problem with it. So,
I think Honda had to do something. Grant, their engines haven't been. It's not like they have been chopped liver or anything, but after getting beat three times in a row, they seem to have an idea. I would figure they'd have an idea of what their deficiencies are, and I would assume they made a pretty good argument to BorgWarner and either them or IndyCar to get a new housing for this, and if it can help them maybe, I don't know, reduce the turbo lag or better throttle response, then obviously Honda's, it behooves them to try and make an appeal on this, you know?
Mm-hmm. The timing is unfortunate, of course, because people can look at that and say, oh, sure, yeah, now you've figured out that you've got this problem, and Indy's right around the corner.
You know, something I would like to ask someone more technical, maybe we could probe Marshall Pruitt for this, because obviously he's technical genius on this type of stuff, but how do you, and maybe somebody listening to this podcast, if anyone's listening to this podcast, maybe you'll make a comment on the page here, but how do you differentiate power that's developed from the engine versus what's coming from the turbocharger? How do we know that Honda engines aren't down, you know, let's just say 10 horsepower, 15 horsepower, just make up a number here. How do you determine whether that 10 to 15 horsepower is from an engine deficiency versus a turbocharger deficiency? I'd be curious how that comes about.
That's a good question. Good question.
Mm-hmm. Hope we get an answer to that. Just a quick little something to touch on is the penalty that KV Racing was issued, announced today as of recording, so Wednesday, that they They failed the post-race inspection on the number 11 entry for Tony Kanaan for having a fuel cell that was allowing for overcapacity. The only penalty they received was an undisclosed fine. So it really doesn't impact too much on anything, but it's worth noting that this can happen. You know, sometimes teams, they're doing their job when they're trying to push things to the limit and maybe a little over, and they went a little over this time, and oops, oh well, it happens. Not a big deal as far as most people will be concerned. Anything to add on that, either of you? No?
Nope.
Not necessarily with that. I just think it's kind of more of it's an open and shut thing, obviously. They did, the special team didn't do something they liked, so they just did what they had to do, and obviously it would just go on to the next round, really.
Yeah. Nice to see that the post-race tech inspection is doing what it's supposed to be doing. That's the only other thing to mention there, I think. Another thing that is that came up today that's worth pointing out, many of you listening at home will have come across More Front Wings event summary pages throughout this season that we've been using to compile statistics and other points, session times, that sort of thing for race weekends. We received a note, a document from IndyCar today indicating that we've been misreporting the team, the outfit within Dragon Racing that is the non-leader circle team. We've been reporting the non-leader circle entry as being Catherine Legg, and the non-leader circle entry is actually the one for Sebastian Bourdais. This is not, from what we understand, what was initially reported. We believe this was a change that was made later after the initial announcement. We have gone back and changed the information in all of our event summary pages to reflect this information. So we apologize for any confusion that may have caused, but this is a point worth discussing because that's a pretty big deal, which of those cars was granted the entry and which of them eventually got it. Now, the non-leader circle entry, for example, Dale Coyne's team was originally to be the number 18. They changed it to the 19 after the fact because they wanted Justin to be in the leader circle car. Now that is a matter of the fact that they obviously pitched for the 19 and didn't get it, but the 18 was already, I'm talking myself in circles here, but the 19 was already a leader circle entry, so they had to pitch for the 18, didn't get it, but since the 19 was already there, that was a little bit more of an obvious switch to say, okay, this isn't such a big deal. But Dragon having pitched for both entries and only received for one, the switching that after the fact, if that is in fact what happened, and we still need to do some verification on that, but is that an okay thing for them to do as far as you guys are concerned, or is that a little bit below the belt?
Well, you know, I went back and looked at all of the releases, at least the official ones from IndyCar, and all of those releases, none of them specified which entry was granted the leader circle status.
We saw some quotes after I was having a discussion on Twitter about this. There were a couple of quotes sent to me from a couple of articles where Randy Bernard specifically referenced Sebastian
right.
Bourdais as being the reason that Dragon was chosen.
Right. Now, absolutely, it was reported, and I think it was in a Racer.com interview that Randy Bernard did. He specifically mentioned Sebastian Bourdais as the driver that would, you know, he was expecting to be in the leader circle program. But if you look at the official releases that came from IndyCar from when they first announced it back, it was about February 9th or 10th, somewhere in that ballpark, all of those said that the leader circle entries had been granted to Ed Carpenter Racing and to Dragon Racing. And it didn't specify which driver or car number was receiving those. So I don't know that – I think everyone assumed that it would be Bourdais, and particularly after the quotes from Randy Bernard in that Racer.com article, where he certainly alluded to Sebastian Bourdais giving or receiving that entry circle. Let me try that again. He certainly referenced Sebastian Bourdais receiving the leader circle entry for Dragon Racing, though he didn't, though it didn't say it in the IndyCar release itself.
Right. So then, when making their pitch, did Dragon do a bait and switch?
I don't know. See, that's what I am trying to get from either IndyCar or Randy Bernard now, and I'm sure everyone, if they're not on the plane yet, they will be here shortly. So getting information from them at this point is going to be a little sketchy over the next 12 to 24 hours. But, you know, certainly you wonder that, of course, there's been this much ballyhooed and joked about 50 million web impressions from Jay Penske that he's talking about. And certainly the fact that you talk about web impressions, and then you look at the sponsors on Sebastian Bourdais' car, you look at McAfee, you look at Bing, you look at a host of other computer and technology groups that are on that car, you certainly, and then putting that with the Randy Bernard quote, you certainly get the impression that IndyCar expected Sebastian Bourdais to be that driver in the leader circle. That being said, I actually think it's a smart move on Dragon Racing.
It's better for Dragon, no question.
Absolutely. If you have your choice between who's going to
earn you more money in the non-leader circle, yeah.
Right. Who are you probably more likely to need to have guaranteed money, Catherine Legg or Sebastian Bourdais? You know, if I have
the spreadsheets today to fix the event summary, he's answered that question pretty handily. He went way up. The team went way up on our winnings list.
Exactly. If I have one of those drivers that I have to have racing for money, I'm going to want Sebastian Bourdais being one of those drivers. And you know, throw out Dragon Racing. If I have one driver, you know, and you don't get to talk about Dario Franchitti, or I'm sorry, Will Power, I take Sebastian Bourdais out of the entire paddock. That's who I want running for my money. So.
Well, let's hope we start to get some answers on that type of thing pretty soon, because it's definitely an interesting issue. And I think a lot of people, given the changes to the way that the leader circle money was doled out to teams that didn't earn it in points, I think a lot of people are going to have a lot of interest in finding out what the deal is with this, so that they can, if nothing else, plan their pitches for next year and how they want to deal with all of it. So, yeah.
Do we know yet what the expected leader circle is supposed to look like for 2013? Are we expecting it to be the top 22 teams from this year again?
I haven't heard any different.
Okay.
So I have not heard anything about that one for 2013.
No. I don't know that they've even looked at it yet necessarily.
But we're not necessarily expecting them to go through this PowerPoint presentation again.
My understanding was that the series was moving toward making everybody justify their leader circle money.
Well, I think after what happened,
to get everybody to earn it, as opposed to just assuming they were going to show up and get the money.
So you would have to assume something is going to get tweaked going into 2013, as you mentioned, not have this entire, this should not have to, like, at least the last two spots not be determined by, as you mentioned, a PowerPoint presentation. I'm sure, I would assume that there are going to be at least a couple tweaks to this process going into next season based on feedback from teams and whatnot.
Yeah, that's something worth looking into, and perhaps we'll do that. So let's just talk about the entry list for the Indy 500 a little bit. Came out last week, 34 cars on it originally. From what we've heard, Ed Carpenter's second car has come out. He's decided that he and the team have decided to focus on just Ed Carpenter's entry, which you have to think is a good move. Michael Shank's entry has been added with Jay Howard signed for that, although they evidently don't have an engine yet. So my understanding, although we still have some TBAs in a couple of the cars there, is that we will still land at about 34 entries This has some people up in arms, oh, there's not going to be much of a bump day. Did you really expect any different for this year? No, I don't think it was reasonable to. Will we see different next year? Almost certainly. One year of you know, a lackluster bump day is worth the sacrifice to get this multiple engine environment off the ground, as far as I'm concerned. Any thoughts to add to that, either of you?
I would agree with that statement wholeheartedly. I mean, what was the most that people were really aiming at as far as like a number of cars in this entry list? Like what, 35, 36, somewhere around there? It wasn't going to be a huge bump day anyway, even if it did hit around 36 or 37 even. So as you mentioned, first year of a new car and engine formula, better to get the growing pains, just have the growing pains now, maybe not have the biggest and baddest bump day ever, but I think it'll pay off in future years, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Well, my concern is that if you think back to 2003 when the Toyota and Honda came in with Chevrolet, we had trouble getting right to 33 that year, but 2004 wasn't a significant bump. I mean, there were two or three years there where it was very tough to get to 33, and you've got A.J. Foyt calling Philippe Giafone out of a Kids R Us. You've got, you know, just these very random last-minute 6 o'clock deals to really even get to 33, let alone 35, 36, 38, something like that. So I just hope that we don't see a repeat of the last engine cycle in 2003, where it took quite a while to really get a healthy field again. So hopefully – again, it goes back to Lotus in 2013, and hopefully they can grow that program and support more cars. Because I don't want to – I'm willing to give up 2012 and say, you know, it's going to be a 33, 34 car year. But I don't want to get into 13, 14, 15 and still be hovering around the 34, 36 car count.
Ever the pessimist, Paul.
Ever the realist, Steph.
Well, I think he may have a point as far as where that boost is going to come from with Lotus. I mean, it really is on them at this point to really grow their ranks pretty much after this. And it may, as Steph alluded to, it may be a little bit tougher to do that after what's happened this season, but they're going to have to do it in order to dodge what happened, as you said, in like 2003 and 2004. As you mentioned, it did take a while for the entry list to grow from that point on the last
cycle.
But
I think that Honda and Chevy are both pretty committed to increasing their inventory and will be able to back more entries next year. I don't see it as being all on Lotus's shoulders. I think both of those companies are highly committed to winning the Indianapolis 500. More than likely, even more so than the series championship. And, more entries is going to help them do that, and I think that it's just the fact that they didn't have time to get the inventory together for this year that was the only deciding factor in not having more cars on the grid. As they have more time this year to get more engines built, I don't see how next year is a problem.
If you could get all three to support 15 entries, I mean, that's a pretty healthy list right there. And even if you only get 10 from Lotus, I mean, you're still talking 15, 15, and 10 gets you to 40. I think that would be a magic number that a lot of fans would like to see.
I think the only way that we see another 34, 35 next year is if Lotus fails completely and Honda and Chevy have to take up the slack. Lotus is there, I think it's going to be a healthy field next year, and there's really nothing to worry about.
We just need to see Lotus just get healthier in the time ahead, pretty much. As you mentioned, obviously Honda and Chevy are very much committed to the series, but even so, you want to have a healthy third manufacturer in there, and if Lotus can get their act together and certainly do that, that would be great, obviously, for the series as a whole, from that regard.
Right. Well, we're getting a little short on time, so we don't want to take too much longer here, but let's just quickly preview São Paulo. Does either of you have the guts to pick anybody other than Will Power? Because he's won the last two races. He's on a hot streak. if you can actually sit here and tell me that anybody else is going to win this race, more power to you.
That was a good one.
as I wrote on the lock drops and sleepers on IndyCar Nation, I was able to keep from picking Will Power as my lock for three whole races that I deserve a cookie for. So that should tell you my aspect. I think this is tailor-made for Power. But then again, a lot of people thought that Honda would win last week. It was tailor-made for them after the Chevy penalties, and look what happened. So never say never, but I would say Power would be a solid prediction.
Yeah, solid prediction doesn't really cover it. I think they're even still calling for rain for this weekend, aren't they?
Yeah.
Which people say is always the great equalizer, but it's also the great Willpower enabler.
The green flag is the great Willpower enabler.
Fair enough. Either way, it should be an interesting weekend and plenty of storylines to follow going into it. Yes, I just double-checked the weather forecast on the event summary page for Sao Paulo that you can find at morefrontwing.com, and today are, in fact, calling for rain for Saturday and Sunday this weekend.
Yeah.
Now, are they calling for regular rain, or are we calling for, like, the Sao Paulo rain, like the monsoon here?
I don't think there is such a thing as regular rain in Sao Paulo.
It's all going down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, we shall see what happens. If Will Power doesn't win, we can all color ourselves shocked. If you're looking for things like times, schedules, session times, that sort of thing, do visit our event summary page. We hope you find it useful, and we will be keeping it updated all weekend long. And I think with that, guys, we can call it a day. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Great to have your insight. We'd love to have you back again sometime. And tell us again where people can find your work.
You can find my work on IndyRacingRevolution.com. And also, as I mentioned, I'm a contributor to IndyCar Nation. So I'm not a hard guy to find. So feel free to drop by a blog, check it out, and obviously feel free to comment on it. I always like to read my comments from those that view my work. So I just want to try and improve it as best I can. So if you got any tips, improvements, let me know.
Great. Paul, anything to throw in here before we sign off?
I will say I did pick Simon Pagenaud as my lock this week on IndyCar Nation.
What?
Yeah, I know. I'm going to hold off on my cookie for a little bit longer.
All right, well, we'll see how that works out for you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks to all of you at home for listening. We greatly appreciate it. And remember, if you need IndyCar news and views, get a grip with More Front Wing.